some sort of refuse collection service, even though they can't provide recycling or garden or a bulky waste collection, which has increased the fly tipping, because they're not being massively impacted by that rubbish collection and the frustrations of the recycling and the garden, they've actually been able to look at the argument at its face value, which is putting themselves in our shoes. Could I afford to lose £8,000 a year, 20% of my annual salary? And they go, no, we can't. So, and they're fully supportive of getting back around the table. So, I mean, they want it settled, and they know that's only done with a negotiated settlement by us getting together.
Okay, Matthew, thank you so much for your time. We'll definitely keep an eye on that and hope at some time Birmingham gets a clean-up. That was Matthew Reed, bin man from Birmingham, Unite convener for the strikes. That is it from me today. I'll be back at 1 o'clock tomorrow, but up next on Times Radio, it's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Trevor, and good afternoon. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
In the next 2 hours, tens of thousands of files relating to the appointment of Peter Mandelson as ambassador to the US have been released. We'll bring you everything you need to know. Our top brains are combing through it all. Finn Lau is a Hong Kong activist who has a £100,000 bounty on his head but is still waiting for British citizenship. We'll ask why. If you've been on social media this week, you may have come across a little monkey in Japan called Punch. He's finally been accepted by his monkey crew. We promised you that story yesterday. Today, we're going to deliver. Vassos will have the sport. And after 3:30, Eric Schlosser will join us to chat about his groundbreaking book, Fast Food Nation.
Here's the news, James Kitchen.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. In the past few minutes, the government has released the first set of documents relating to the appointment of Peter Mandelson as British ambassador to the US. It's expected the files will reveal details about the process prior to Lord Mandelson taking up the role in Washington in December 2024. The former cabinet minister was arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office last month before being released under investigation. He denies any wrongdoing. Lord Mandelson's biographer, Donald McIntyre, told Times Radio Keir Starmer's judgment will come under further scrutiny.
If, for example, the cabinet office made it clear to the prime minister that there was a considerable reputational risk in appointing Peter Mandelson, as one or two sort of rather half-hearted leaks have suggested, then I think that does call into question his judgment. And therefore, it means that it will be that much more difficult for him to shake off the incubus of the appointment.
Times Radio will have full coverage throughout the afternoon. Elsewhere, Iran's military commands warned the world should prepare for fuel costs to double as three more vessels are attacked in a key shipping route. The cargo ships were hit with projectiles in the Strait of Hormuz, which normally carries a fifth of the world's oil. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has told MPs it's certainly not good for the British economy. Meanwhile, Sir Keir Starmer's denied accusations the government's increasing the cost of petrol.
Fuel duty is frozen. It's going to remain frozen until September. And we will keep the situation under review in light of what's happening in Iran. The most important issue is de-escalating the situation.
Meanwhile, the Home Secretary has confirmed a ban on the Al-Quds Day march in London will last a month. Shabana Mahmood said the Iran conflict had created clear challenges for police, arguing officers can't guarantee the capital's safety without a ban. Earlier, the Islamic Human Rights Commission, which is behind the protests, said it will go ahead on Sunday as a static demonstration. Addressing MPs this afternoon, the Home Secretary insisted the restrictions were limited and specific.
Peaceful and lawful protest, whether for Palestine or for Israel or for any other cause, must be cherished and protected, and this government will always defend that sacred freedom. At the same time, as Home Secretary, I have a solemn duty, and it is my first duty, to keep the British people safe.
A van has been driven through a security barricade near the White House in Washington, D.C. The driver's been arrested by Secret Service agents and police are now investigating the incident. No injuries have been reported. A school on the outskirts of Norwich is in lockdown after a teenage girl was stabbed there this morning. Police have arrested a 16-year-old boy and the victim's been taken to hospital with minor injuries. Norfolk Police says the incident in Thorpe St Andrew is not believed to be related to a hate crime reported at the same school last week. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. Welcome. Could be an interesting old afternoon. Hope you can stay with us until 4 o'clock. The WhatsApp, if you want to chip in, is 0333 003 2353. The Mandelson files have been released and we are combing through them, so there'll be much more just as soon as we can be certain about what's in them. But we are talking to Ollie Wright in a couple of minutes' time. He can give us his initial take. That lovely story, heartbreaking stuff about the isolated lonely monkey and his cuddly toy, it's back. And as Fee said a moment or so ago, today we really are going to talk about it, aren't we?
I don't want to tempt fate by agreeing with you, but yes, we hope to.
Absolutely. We'll talk to the A&E doctor campaigning for more research into so-called rare diseases and why he believes artificial intelligence could help. We've got the week's top TV talking points with Scott Bryan. Are you enjoying Vladimir on Netflix? Or like Fee and the TV reviewer in The Sun, are you a little bit unnerved by it all? Fee's going to talk to the Hong Kong pro-democracy campaigner struggling to get British citizenship, and sport with the king of the showbiz anecdote, Vassos Alexander, will have the latest from Cheltenham, and it's yet another difficult day to be a fan of Tottenham Hotspurs. But the big guest after 3.30 is...
It is Eric Schlosser. Now, 25 years ago, Eric, as a younger journalist, did an article for Rolling Stone magazine about what lay behind the hatch in the fast food industry in America. And what he found was so dark and sinister, and to a journalist, almost impossible, a little bit like the products themselves, to resist, Jane, that he then wrote a book called Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. It has been reprinted, republished to celebrate 25 years, but it's a muted celebration, isn't it? Because Eric would be the first person to acknowledge that all of the work that he did back then that made people really raise their eyebrows and really shout with protest about what was happening in the fast food industry has not really got better. In fact, in some cases, it has got decidedly worse. So we talk about 2.5 decades of filling your face with fries and hamburgers. And also, his real point in the book wasn't actually about the health effects on us. It's about the effect on the wider economy, certainly on the workers producing all of this stuff for us. And that happy, shiny thing that lures you into the Golden Arches or Wendy's or KFC or whatever it is, the light really isn't shining very brightly elsewhere in that food chain. So, it's not going to be the most cheery of interviews after 3.30, but by Jiminy Jane, it will be informative.
Thank you very much. And we'll get stuck into a burger or two after 3.30 in the company of Eric Schlosser. Right, before we talk PMQs and the Mandelson files, which, just to emphasise, have just been released, let's find out what are the most read stories on the Times website.
In at number three, Prince Harry partied with Mail on Sunday journalist. The Mail on Sunday's editor-at-large, Charlotte Griffiths, told the Prince's privacy trial that he sent her his phone number via Facebook. The second most read story, British couple drown in front of family at Australian beach. The holidaymakers, both in their 60s, were given CPR by locals and paramedics, but they could not be resuscitated. The most read piece so far today on the Times website is Iran's latest fuel duty under review. Starmer says the PM has hinted the freeze may be extended. That's as Rachel Reeves warns of harm to the UK economy as more ships come under attack in the Strait of Hormuz. Peter Aylott of the UK Chamber of Shipping told Times Radio Breakfast that Iranian strikes on shipping are an attempt to enlarge the conflict.
They're in that situation tactically and strategically for Iran. They need to spread the risk of this conflict across as many states as possible, particularly Gulf states, but obviously other states that need cargoes from that area, whether it be gas or whether it be oil or other products. And this, I think, is the next escalation of their strategy to remind many operators that vessels could be at threat from mines if they so wish to do it.
That was the Director of Policy at the UK Chamber of Shipping. You can hear Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel every day, Monday through Thursday from 6 till 10 a.m. And the live page on the Times is where you can find out details of what these files on Peter Mandelson's appointment are going to reveal. That page has been constantly updated. All of the big brains are sifting through the files at the moment. So take a look whenever you fancy. You can read that at thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. How can you not have one? If you don't have one, though, do get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
Right, let's go straight to Ollie Wright, who is the Times policy editor. I know it's very, very early days, Ollie, but what so far can we glean from the Mandelson files that have dropped?
I mean, I think the first thing to say is they're not the Epstein files. There's not sort of thousands and thousands of these documents. A lot of the information that's going to be released has had to go through the ISC. There are issues over what is sensitive diplomatically, what is sensitive for security grounds. And there's also the question of what the Metropolitan Police want held back. So what we have got is we've got the initial sort of due diligence report that the Cabinet Office did into Peter Mandelson. And, you know, as we suspected, it was largely just a sort of trawl through what was known in public. There was not a huge vetting exercise done into him. We've also, interestingly, got some documents going back to 2002, which are memos between Mandelson and Jonathan Powell that refer to Epstein. So, yeah, this is the scope of the trawl is pretty huge, but the number of documents that's actually been released today is not that vast.
I see. So do you think, from what you can understand so far, will this present some troubling questions for the Prime Minister and his judgment?
I think those questions are already there. Whether these documents in particular add to that is hard to know. I mean, some of them talk about Mandelson's views on China, which he was quite favourable towards, the fact that his business had connections in Russia, all those kind of things. Are uncomfortable for the government. You know, they are things which we broadly know before. But the point about this, I think, is that, you know, these are official documents telling Starmer this, warning him, and he went ahead with the appointment anyway. So I think that's where the political difficulty is.
Right. Okay. I mean, of course, it's worth saying that these files were only published after PMQs were safely behind the Prime Minister. The way the world is right now, we could very easily have moved on by next Wednesday. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, you know, this is in some ways for the government having, you know, these files released now when everyone is sort of concentrating on events in the Middle East is probably, you know, not unhelpful. But, you know, there are going to be more documents released as time goes on. You've obviously got the criminal case against Mandelson. So this, you know, this sort of scandal is going to sort of hang around Starmer's neck really for quite a long time, long after one would suspect that the war in the Middle East is over. But, you know, in terms of releasing these documents, I think they will be a little bit relieved that perhaps, you know, events elsewhere may take some of the sting out of them.
Yeah, Mandelson was, he was filmed, I think, wasn't he, leaving his house today, and somebody shouted, "Did you lie to the Prime Minister?" And he didn't reply. So presumably we don't know any more about his movements.
We don't. We do know that the police have returned his passport following his arrest because they were sort of fearful, something that Mandelson totally denied, that he could be a flight risk. I mean, our understanding of it is that, you know, this police investigation is going to be long and quite drawn out. I mean, one of the problems is they have to go to America to get the original copies of the files that were released by the Department of Justice in order to bring this prosecution. The fact that they've been released on email is not enough for the court. They need the originals. That is going to be quite a sort of cumbersome and long drawn out process. You know, this is also about events. The court case is about events that took place in 2009. The release of these sort of documents to Epstein, private confidential government documents to Epstein. It's quite an untried law. The Crown Prosecution Service will be involved. I mean, I don't think anyone should be really thinking about sort of charges anytime soon.
Right, but as you mentioned earlier, that the Metropolitan Police have insisted that some material is held back just in case.
Yes, the particular document that they don't want released at this stage is Manderson was given an additional number of questions following the due diligence report that he was asked to answer. And those, I think, did include his asking him about his relationship with Epstein, the depth of it, how long it went on for. And it's his answers to those questions that the Metropolitan Police have said that they do not want released at this stage.
Right. Thank you very much. And thank you for attempting to... Well, it's so difficult when literally, I think they dropped it about 10 to 2, didn't they? So it's really, really tough. And we appreciate your diligent responses so far. Let's talk about PMQs today then.
Yeah.
And now, this was an opportunity for a traditional ding-dong. I'm not sure who came off best today or whether anybody did, but here is the Prime Minister accusing the leader of the opposition, Kemi Badenoch, of the mother of all U-turns over the war in Iran.
Mr. Speaker, as I said to the House last week, I took the decision that we should not join the initial US-Israeli offensive against Iran. The leader of the opposition attacked me for that decision relentlessly. She said that the UK should have joined the US and Israel in the initial offensive strikes. Mr. Speaker, then yesterday, in the wake of the economic consequences, the leader of the opposition totally abandoned her position. She told the BBC, "I never said we should join." She told the BBC, "I haven't said we should have gone in with the United States." That is the mother of all U-turns on the single most important decision a Prime Minister ever has to take, whether to commit the United Kingdom to war or not.
Right. Well, Kemi Badenoch did make some gains on the domestic front when the Prime Minister admitted he will keep the rate of fuel duty under review.
Mr. Speaker, I think the mother of all U-turns is him saying that they're not increasing fuel duty. That is news to us because last week the Chancellor stood up and said the fuel duty was going to increase in September. The Prime Minister told us at the start of the year that the cost of living was his number one priority. So can he explain how a rise in fuel duty helps with the cost of living?
Mr. Speaker, fuel duty is frozen. It's going to remain frozen until September. And we will keep the situation under review in light of what's happening in Iran. But, Mr. Speaker, the most important issue is de-escalating the situation.
Right, Oliver, tell me, is the Prime Minister, actually not the Prime Minister, is Kemi Badenoch guilty of this so-called mother of U-turns? She isn't the only one, as the Prime Minister pointed out. Reform have had a few changes of mind as well.
Yeah, I mean, everyone has been trying to sort of triangulate and articulate their position on this amongst ever-shifting stands. I certainly don't think it's the mother of all U-turns. Kemi Badenoch wanted to sort of contrast Starmer's action on this and the sort of indecisiveness that she accused him of in the first instance with, you know, the Tories being much more prepared to sort of act in America's interest. But, you know, she had a slightly more nuanced view than Starmer put out there at PMQs. But it's difficult for everyone in all this because, you know, there's this distinction. They want to remain close to America. They see America as an ally, both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. It's the question is, how far do you go with this? And this is a dilemma that, you know, very acutely faces Starmer, but also, as you point out, it faces Kemi Badenoch and Reform UK as well.
Right. I mean, the fuel prices, there was that event yesterday with Mr. Jenrick and Mr. Farage at a petrol station.
Yes.
I mean, that was a fairly extraordinary, brilliant sketch on that by Tom Peck, by the way, in the Times Day. Very funny. Why do you think Kemi Badenoch went for the same story, the same angle today? Isn't that a bit bizarre?
No, I think what she has identified, and rightly so, is that the long-term consequences of this conflict, depending on how long it lasts, is the cost of living. And, you know, the government, under its current plans, does intend to increase fuel duty from the autumn. Now, that is a real political problem for them if you still have elevated petrol and diesel prices at the pump. They were hoping to take advantage, the government this was, of the low price of oil to unwind this 5p cut that was first brought in by Rishi Sunak. They're going to unwind it over a period of time so that people didn't notice. But clearly, if you've got high petrol and diesel prices, that becomes almost impossible to do. And I mean, Rachel Reeves said she was loath to reverse ferret and not to increase petrol and fuel duty because the government needs the money. But I think, you know, if this conflict drags on and if, you know, petrol prices remain elevated, this is really hard to see how the government does this. And I think Kemi Badenoch was frankly punching a bruise as far as this is concerned.
Can we just mention the Al-Quds march planned for Sunday, now banned by the Home Secretary after a request from the Metropolitan Police? Here is the Home Secretary explaining why she'd approved that request.
The Commissioner has clearly stated that the Metropolitan Police's view is that serious public disorder cannot be avoided unless a prohibition under Section 13 is introduced. This assessment is grounded in the tensions created by international conflict, the scale of the expected march, and the presence of protesters and multiple counter-protesting groups, all seeking to march at once.
So there is still going to be a so-called static demonstration, isn't there? And you have to wonder whether, in fact, this problem has not really been solved.
Yeah, I mean, I think the police would argue that a static demonstration is a huge amount easier to police than a moving one. But, you know...
Well,
you
effectively, will that mean people being, what's the expression, kettle, just kept in a tight area?
Yeah. Well, I think the police would say it wasn't kettling, but yes, there would be a defined area, and that would probably, you know, there would be some sort of barriers to prevent people from sort of going elsewhere. But, yeah, I think it is... a political decision as much as a policing one. Clearly the police were uncomfortable with it going ahead, but also at the same time, you know, Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, would be very uncomfortable with allowing that march to take place in the first place. So I think there's probably an alignment of what the police think and what the ministers think.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Ollie. That's Ollie Wright, the Times policy editor, doing a sterling job there of summing up Prime Minister's questions and telling us so far what he knows from the Mandelson file dump that occurred about 10 to 2.
We'll bring you more news as we get it that.
It is just worth saying that Sky are reporting that he asked for £500,000 as a payoff.
The Times live page is reporting 550. 550.
Yes. And in the end, what did he get?
I'm not sure he got that.
No, I think he got $70,000, something like that.
Well,
I
mean, not to be sniffed at.
No, it's not.
In and of itself. Just a tiny bit from that political sketch that you and Ollie were talking about, courtesy of the fabulous Tom Peck in the paper today. So he attended the stunt that was being done by Nigel Farage and Bobby Jenrick at New Haven Services near Buxton in Derbyshire. They've gone there to talk about taking down the price of petrol. I'll give you just a little flavour of the sketch. Given the government is urging drivers to avoid unnecessary car journeys, I wouldn't necessarily recommend an 8-hour, 400-mile round trip from London solely to bag a 25p a litre discount on fuel. But it wasn't just me, writes Tom. An official 48-seat reform bus also set off from the capital at 5am yesterday so that other people could witness Farage selling cheap petrol. When it arrived at 9:45, it contained one passenger.
So the one passenger and the driver. Okay, yes. Right.
Coming up, is there hope at last in the saga of Punch the Monkey? You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Global events.
How difficult is it for culture in Ukraine to thrive when the country's under assault?
Breaking news.
A crisis that has spiralled into the Middle East as competition for resources intensifies.
Reactive analysis.
We'll consider what's at stake for both leaders and our national politics.
From the world's best journalists.
Two people with different perspectives tell us what they think about today's events.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Hello, Greg James here.
And I'm Seema Pankhania.
And we're the hosts of the Tesco Kitchen.
Every week, Greg and I invite a culinary powerhouse into the kitchen to cook a recipe that really means something to them.
Hold on to your hairnets, because this week we're joined by chef, musician and host of Big Zoo's Big Eats. You might have guessed it. It's Big Zoo!
Zoo is taking us on a trip down memory lane and showing us how to cook the lasagna that changed his life forever.
It's live right now on YouTube, so get involved.
The award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Transform your kitchen or bathroom. Wix has everything you need, plus all the finishing touches, from beautiful tiles and flooring to a wide choice in paint and lighting. Whatever you're planning, create the perfect space with Wix.
We are 0333 003 2353 this afternoon and every afternoon. Anything that we're talking about, we love it. If you join in with us now, regular listeners and dedicated listeners will know that yesterday we did try and bring you the uplifting story of Punch the Monkey. Clips of the young macaque went viral after he was rejected by his mother and troupe at a zoo in Japan, and instead he'd found solace with a stuffed orangutan from IKEA. It could happen to any of us. No need to feel sorry for Punch now, because he's finally found acceptance, being groomed and hugged by the adults of his clan. Well, let's catch up with biologist and primate specialist Professor Ben Garrod from the University of East Anglia. Professor Garrod, a very good afternoon from us.
Hi.
Good. Oh, my goodness, I do love an enthusiastic hello. For people who haven't heard of Punch, can you just tell us a little bit more about his story? Because the poor little thing has been through quite a lot, hasn't he?
He has, but I will say right from the get-go, being a young monkey is never an easy thing. This idea of living in these big, wonderful social groups isn't quite as it's cut out to be. It's not Disney out there, it's nature. So these poor little monkeys do find themselves on the receiving end of quite strict pecking orders. But little Punch is what we call a Japanese macaque, and they're found across Japan. They live in big, big multi-male, multi-female groups. They're the ones that are famous for sitting in those warm, hot baths. But little Punch found himself rejected, as you said earlier, by mum, and then the rest of the group turned against him, which is something we often see, both in the wild and captivity. But as you said there, Fee, happy ending. He's been welcomed back with open arms and he's been groomed once again.
So why are babies often rejected by their mothers or by others? Because that just seems to go against the kind of the rules of the wild.
It does in some ways, but then in others it doesn't also. So we do see a rejection of male infants quite often in some primates, especially when environmental conditions are tough. It's easier to produce males in many ways. They are, how do I put this, less of an investment from an evolutionary perspective. Whereas if you have females who can come to bear, they are the ones who are giving birth to the next generation. It almost seems pre-programmed in some primate species where male rejection is often higher when conditions aren't great. And it could be environmental conditions, it could be stress. We do also see young, inexperienced mothers rejecting their offspring more regularly, both in the wild and captivity. And I will say that sometimes in zoos and other captive environments, the conditions aren't quite right for happy breeding and happy parenthood. So you do see sometimes rejections of young ones in a zoo setting as well.
Right. This is all a slap in the face for the primate patriarchy, Ben.
Well, I'm really glad you said that, Fee, because this is a species that is what we call matrilineal. So I think many people will assume that the males are very dominant and this is the way that the natural order of things. It's not that common in primate societies, actually. So we see things like baboons and many macaque species, even bonobos. Some of our closest living relatives are female-led within their dominance hierarchies. And these macaques will have multi-lines of female dominance running through these bigger groups. So a young male born into this social structure is the lowest ranking animal there is,
right?
Unfortunately for him.
Wow, I didn't know any of that at all. And if the lovely, cuddly, great big floppy orangutan from IKEA hadn't been available to Punch, what would have happened to him?
So very often with these young animals, you can take them out and hand rear them. I've been lucky enough to see this done in a wild setting. So chimps and gorillas, for example, that come in via the pet trade or even bushmeat trade, even very young animals who are quite traumatized can respond really well to quite intensive hand rearing and then be assimilated back either into the wild or into a social group. And the same thing probably would have happened with Punch. Someone would have taken him in within the zoo community that they have there, raised him up, got him healthy, and hopefully then either assimilated him back into his own group or could have moved him into a different zoo or ultimately, hopefully, back into the wild, which is where these animals belong.
Yep. I mean, I know it won't mean anything to Punch, but the parasocial love that this macaque has received is absolutely extraordinary. He's known across the world because all of the clips went viral. And thank goodness it is so far a story with a happy ending. Lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. That is biologist and primate specialist, Professor Ben Garrod.
Oh, that was properly educational, wasn't it? Poor little monkey, though. Do feel sorry for him. Now, let's head to the Commons. The Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister, Darren Jones, on his feet, explaining the Prime Minister's reaction to the release of the Mandelson files.
Madam Deputy Speaker, it is important to recognise the strength of feeling on all sides of the House, my own included, of the disgust and horror at the nature and extent of the relationship that Peter Mandelson maintained with Jeffrey Epstein despite his criminal conviction for abusing a vulnerable young girl, including encouraging Jeffrey Epstein to then fight that conviction. Jeffrey Epstein was a despicable criminal who committed the most horrifying and disgusting crimes that destroyed the lives of countless women and girls. What he did is, of course, unforgivable, and his victims, I know, will be in the thoughts and prayers of all members across this House as we debate these issues today. Those victims will always be our first priority, and Peter Mandelson's behaviour was an insult to them and their suffering. And can I say, Madam Deputy Speaker, that I am therefore sorry that these events leave those victims with no choice but to relive their horrors with still too little justice being served. That is why there is, I think, Madam Deputy Speaker, a cross-party consensus in this House for full transparency and accountability, why anybody with knowledge must cooperate with inquiries, whether in the United Kingdom or elsewhere, and why the government is therefore committed to publishing all documents relevant to the humble address. Madam Deputy Speaker, the Prime Minister has taken responsibility for Peter Mandelson's appointment as ambassador to the United States. He has acknowledged it was a mistake and has apologised, not least for believing Peter Mandelson's lies. As the government has said previously, there are specific documents that this government would like to have been able to disclose today, but which the Metropolitan Police have asked us not to do so yet.
The words of Darren Jones, MP, Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister. He's on his feet in the House of Commons. So that story obviously will keep on unravelling during the course of the programme. Is it worth saying that, in fact, apparently the amount of money that Peter Mandelson, Lord Mandelson, requested when he was fired from his ambassadorship in Washington was?
£547,000. Another email in the files shows that the agreed settlement was eventually £75,000. So if we cast our minds back to why he had lost that position, it was because of his connections to a convicted paedophile. Mm-hmm. I just personally think the gall of somebody expecting £500,000, yeah, in compensation for what? For what? It is boggling of the mind.
What's the expression? Brass neck.
Yes, that. That too, Jane.
Absolutely. Right, you too can take part in this. 0333 003 2353 is the WhatsApp number. Good afternoon to you. You're with Times Radio. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover until 4 o'clock. And next, how do you find cures for some of the rarest diseases on the planet? Here are the headlines just after 2:30. James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Newly released files reveal Sir Keir Starmer was told his former Director of Communications, Matthew Doyle, was satisfied with Peter Mandelson's explanation over his friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. Documents published in the past hour relate to the peer's appointment as ambassador to Washington. The files show the Prime Minister's National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell, said the appointment was weirdly rushed and unusual. They also reveal Lord Mandelson asked for more than £500,000 as a severance payment when he was sacked from the role in September last year. The former cabinet minister received £70,000 instead. The Times newsroom reporter Ollie Cole says the files will provide an insight into the Prime Minister's decision-making.
There is a difficulty here that we shouldn't apply too much hindsight. Obviously, we've had a lot of Department of Justice documents from the US to look through over the last sort of couple of months, and we know a lot more now than we did then. But this document will already lay out what was known about that relationship, and it goes to the heart of Keir Starmer's judgment and the people around him's judgment.
Iran is warning the world should prepare for fuel costs to double as three more ships are attacked on a key shipping route. The Chancellor's admitted the war in the Middle East is certainly not good for the UK economy, while the Prime Minister says a planned hike in fuel duty is now under review. The government has lost its appeal over a terror charge against a member of the Irish language rap trio Kneecap. Liam O'Hanley had been accused of showing support for the proscribed organisation Hezbollah following a gig in London in 2024. Last year, the case was thrown out over a legal timing issue, but the government appealed the decision. Unite is to cut its Labour affiliation by £580,000. It's amid anger over the long-running Birmingham bin strike. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Hello, Greg James here.
And I'm Seema Pankhania.
And we're the hosts of The Tesco Kitchen.
Every week, Greg and I invite a culinary powerhouse into the kitchen to cook a recipe that really means something to them.
Hold on to your hairnets, because this week we're joined by chef, musician and host of Big Zoo's Big Eats. You might have guessed it. It's Big Zoo.
Zoo is taking us on a trip down memory lane and showing us how to cook the lasagna that changed his life forever.
It's live right now on YouTube, so get involved.
Put a tool in Aaron Gemmell's hand and he can fix just about anything. Put his business finances in front of him and he wasn't so confident. A carpenter by trade, Aaron runs checklist property maintenance. He had all the right tools for the job, but not for his numbers. Invoicing, tax, paying suppliers, it all took time he didn't have. That's where Xero came in. Xero is the ultimate small business accounting tool in Aaron's kit. It gives him full control over everything financial, all in one place. As his business has grown, Xero has been a game changer, especially with meeting the new Making Tax Digital for Income Tax rules. It doesn't just help Aaron stay compliant, it gives him better visibility and control day to day. Xero even generates smart, professional quotes and invoices, which Aaron says gives him a competitive edge. Now Xero takes care of the numbers so Aaron can get back on the tools and get the job done right for his customers. With Xero, you can change the way you see MTD. Search MTD Ready.
Daryl Morris brings you a first look at the Sunday Times front page splash every Saturday night from 10:30.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Callum McDonald is presenting Drive this afternoon in the place of John Pienaar. Well, I mean, you've got your own big place on the network haven't you?
Not at all. Just an average, moderate-sized space where I like to say things out loud.
Can I do a couple of thoughts from, from our listeners? Brian says, I don't believe for a second these sycophants who quote that their thoughts and prayers are with the victim, such hand-wringing, and then I can't read out that word, Brian. But Jane and I are completely with you on that. And in fact, if you want to tune in into Off Air with Jane and Fee, our podcast that drops every day, sometime around the 6 o'clock mark. We quite often discuss exactly that. It's become a really meaningless phrase, and actually that time, if you've got a big platform, could be spent explaining an awful lot more about how it feels to be a victim or survivor. And Simon says, Jane and Fee, I think the expression you're seeking is WTF, and it absolutely is, Simon, but we're governed by the laws of broadcasting, so we have to go for things like bunkum, and what did you say?
Brass neck, that man's got.
But you know exactly what it is that we are thinking. You're probably thinking it too. Callum, I think this might be where you start today, although there are, you know, massive world events to cover too, so yeah. You tell us.
Yeah, no, there's a lot, as you say, going on. So on Peter Mandelson, we've got people who are reading through what has been released today, such as becoming tradition with these sorts of... By the way, tranche is really as a word that's having its moment today, isn't it? This tranche of files.
That's a good one,
as
yes.
We'll be entranched from 4 o'clock and as to what they say. And we'll, as people are reading through them, as our reporters and teams are reading through them, we will bring you more information. At the moment, it does seem like the biggest things to mention are the warning that the Prime Minister got of the reputational risk that would come with appointing Peter Mandelson was written there in black and white. And then the other part of it on the brass neck front was his demand for a £500,000 plus payout. He ended up getting £75,000, which in the emails and letters and things is actually that the person who managed to get to £75,000 is given a reasonable amount of credit, given that they had to start at 500 and they got to 75. Make of that what you will. I mean, there are other things in there as well. I think we're sort of... with these things, I always think it's the seeing it in black and white. You might have read it in the newspaper and it had been, you know, maybe it's been briefed by sources or whatever, or you've seen a snippet of an email in the past. And then when you see it laid out, it sort of does bring it... It makes it very real. So there's a message in there about... Peter Mandelson seemingly trying to facilitate a meeting between Tony Blair and Jeffrey Epstein on the advice or with the sort of nudge and encouragement of Bill Clinton. And so when you see all of these people written down, you know, one after the other in a sentence saying Clinton thinks it's a good idea to do this, and, you know...
And do we know the date of that one?
I haven't written down the date. It'll be on there, but I don't know when it was. It was when Blair was PM, for
right.
sure.
Mm.
And there was a phrase in there that Mandelson described Epstein as safe. I don't really know what that means, especially given all that was known then and all that we know now. In any case, we will go through the tranche of Mandelson files. And then, yes, also on world events. So we're keeping an eye on strategic oil reserves this afternoon and what these G7 countries are going to decide and how quickly they're going to decide how many barrels of oil they may release from their reserves to try to keep prices down. I mean, there's been discussion already on Times Radio today about whether it will actually do that. There have been examples in recent memory of releasing strategic oil reserves, and actually worries everyone more that the war is going to be more protracted, and therefore it sends prices up rather than bringing them down. So we'll try to assess exactly what the outcome is. Also, a story that was just thrown at me on my way through. French teenagers are apparently smoking less. Which I think is notable because they're teenagers and they're French. But I do think that there's a potential sort of general young people are harming themselves less in those sorts of ways, cigarettes, alcohol, etc. Are you interested in the fact it's French teenagers? There's a cultural thing there, isn't there?
Yes, I mean, I know what you mean, because it's so much part of the stereotype
yeah.
of France, isn't it? That you would have hanging out of your pouting lips a chitin. And it would make you incredibly cool. And you're absolutely right that, you know, behind the bike chairs with a JPS somewhere north of Slough does not have the same connotation. Maybe it's easier to give up the latter than the former. Obviously it is.
I have friends who only used to smoke when on holiday in Europe.
That's so funny. As soon as they get across
yeah,
the border.
That was it. They'd just go for it. Just for a week and then that'd be fine. Back home again.
I wish I'd had that kind of lack of addiction
yeah,
that I'd just be able to stop in a different country.
Yes, there you are. Lots coming up after four.
Look forward to it. Callum McDonald here, 4 till 7 this afternoon.
Yeah, that should be good. Now let's talk about DeSanto-Shinawi syndrome. It's actually one of the rarest diseases we know about. Identified just over a decade ago, only 200 people have it currently. And there is no treatment. That's, by the way, 200 people on Earth. But what if a cure, or even something that could just help, could be discovered in medicines or research that's already been produced? Now, that is the goal of the charity Rare People. It's founded by A&E doctor Rob Galloway. Rob, good afternoon to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a great pleasure, and I know this is of huge significance to you. So tell us about your daughter and indeed about when she was diagnosed.
Yes, my daughter's nearly two now, and when she was a newborn baby, she got meningitis, and she got better from that, but she recovered quite slowly from her development, and we put her slow development down to meningitis. But we realised eventually that actually she was way behind what we'd expect. We saw paediatricians, and then they did genetic testing, and it came back as this thing called DeSanto-Shinawi syndrome. Now, initially, we were quite relieved because we thought it could be a lot worse, but then when we found out about it, it was quite devastating in many ways. She'll need lifelong care. She's got significant learning disabilities, problems walking, problems talking, immune problems. And she's only just got out of hospital late last night because she's got problems metabolizing glucose, which meant she became quite drowsy and needed infusions of glucose. So it's quite a difficult condition to live with all her life, I say. And there was no treatment. And as an A&E doctor, I've worked in A&E for 24 years, I'm used to be able to provide a treatment. And so that felt really quite difficult. Just after we got our diagnosis, I found out about what was happening in the Mayo Clinic in America. And the story actually goes back 14 years before my daughter's diagnosis, where a gentleman who was an AI professor, even before people knew what AI was, his son got diagnosed with an equally rare genetic condition. And he basically repurposed his AI expertise to interrogate every single scientific paper ever published to see if there could be potential connections between drugs and genetic diseases when you are losing a gene and you've got a loss of a protein. And he managed to find potential connections for his son, and only in July last year was the computer program published. And the very, very first case they tried it on was actually a girl who had the same condition as my daughter in America. And it seemed to do some good in the test tube, and it seemed to do some good in the one child that's been used. And I got working with the Mayo team to look at, could we actually use this AI invention to look at loads of other rare conditions? And so we set up a charity called Rare People to do that, with the hope to start the trials, into trials which otherwise wouldn't happen.
Right, because in a way, the expression rare disease is a bit misleading, isn't it? Because there must be hundreds of thousands of people with a so-called rare disease on Earth.
Absolutely. There's 7,000 rare conditions. Now, if you add up the total number of people with, you know, there's only 200 in the whole wide world who've got my daughter's condition, but if you times 7,000 by 200, then that's a hell of a lot of people who at the moment you're told there's no hope, no treatments, nothing can be done. But AI is showing that you can repurpose existing drugs and they could work in the most unexpected ways by activating the damaged gene. So it's much, much cheaper than normal drug development, which costs a lot of money to develop the drug, then do safety testing. It's a lot cheaper than genetic engineering, which you have to create difficult vectors to get into the brain cells to change actual genes. This is actually the downstream processes where the damaged gene doesn't make enough protein. You can upregulate the protein production unexpectedly using these AI repurposed drugs. And so the charity we've set up is really to do the most cost-effective of drug trials into kids who are otherwise told you had no hope.
Right. And I understand that COVID played a part here.
Yeah, this gentleman's poor son, he basically discovered a drug totally unexpectedly, which could help his son, and he got a bit better. And normally people with his son's condition died quite young, but his son lived till 12 years old and then died during COVID, tragically, as a complication of COVID. But he then carried on doing the work to allow the computer programming to be used for all the other very rare genetic conditions. And we're incredibly grateful for the work he's done, which has basically been inspiration behind the charity we've set up. And I'm hoping, obviously I'm connecting the medical world, that the charity will become a big funding organisation, which can then fund lots and lots of other research. You know, we don't have any fixed costs. We've got no employees, no offices. 100% of, you know, what is donated goes to the research. And so we're hoping that, obviously, it's tragic what's happened to my daughter, that good can come from it. And so if anybody is interested in helping or supporting or being an ambassador or donating, please go to www.rarepeople.org.
Oh, well, thank you for making that so plain, Rob. I mean, do you worry about what would have happened had you, frankly, not been a doctor. I mean, it's brilliant that you can advocate so powerfully for your daughter, but so many parents just wouldn't have been able to.
It's not being a doctor because 6 months ago, 9 months ago, this technology didn't exist. So obviously, you know, she's just come out of hospital yesterday and we got the most amazing care, and that was helped because I know everyone in the hospital and I can understand what's going on. But it's not being a doctor which is offering hope. AI is utterly changing the future of medicine, and it didn't exist 9 months ago. You know, it's only because medicine's changing so much. And, you know, AI does get a bad name because it's being used in some dreadful ways. You know, you just have to look at the news, but there is so much potential of using it for good. And it's, you know, there's thousands and thousands of drugs. You can't trial it on every single, you know, you can't try it on every single one. But this tells you which ones may work. And so, you know, we're going to trial it on my daughter's condition, the concept, and we believe it will work. We need to raise another £150,000 to complete the trial. We've got enough money to start the trial. But then we want to raise it for hundreds of other conditions. So we really are hoping that, and in many ways, I'm repurposing my life. Obviously, I'm still working as an A&E consultant and work at a university, but really trying to use some of my contacts and networks to try and get this charity to grow. And that's why I'm so grateful to come on, tell people what's happening, because this is a completely unique charity in the UK. It doesn't exist. It's very different to any other medical research charity. And we're just hoping this could be the start of something really special, which could save, you know, really help thousands and thousands of other kids with rare conditions.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. And the very best of luck to you. And I hope your daughter is on the mend. It sounds like she's had a tough time lately. Thank you, Rob. That is Rob Galloway. He's a professor. He is based at Brighton NHS Trust.
We'll give out that address that he gave out in the next half an hour of the programme again, in case you did want to make a donation and didn't have time to catch it. Coming up, though, what telly should you watch this week? That's where we're going to go next. It's 12 minutes to three. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
On Booking.com, it's easy to book your holiday home. And thanks to no hidden fees, there's no more...
Guys, found a villa, I'm confirming. Wait. Added fees?
We don't do sneaky added fees. So you can go from home to holiday home with no dramas.
And relax.
On Booking.com, finding a holiday home's easy. Booking.com. Booking.com.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Vladimir, no, not that one. It's Netflix's new steamy dark comedy. It stars Rachel Weisz as a professor who embarks on an affair with her much younger colleague, who's played by Leo Woodall. Let's talk to Scott Bryan, TV critic to The Stars. Hello, Scott. How are you this week?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yes, I'm all right, but I did try watching Vladimir and I felt no better about the world or my place in it. What do you reckon?
I mean, I can certainly see where you're coming from. I mean... One upside of this show is that there are only 30-minute episodes. So,
come on, Scott.
That's fantastic when you start a review by saying at least the episodes are short.
But I think what it does well also is you know, Rachel Weisz, it has that kind of House of Cards-esque element in which they constantly break the fourth wall. And I like the friction and the fact that she does some things which really frustrate you, and she's saying one version of events, so then you're clearly seeing another. And I think... the setting of, as well, the generational divide that is very much at the heart of this drama, which is an adaptation of a very successful book. Basically, one of the themes that runs through the series is why her character, who is just called M, is deciding to stand by her husband when her husband has been sleeping with a member of a student faculty. So I think that there are elements within it that I found it enjoyable. I think the part of the show that just didn't really feel right to me is, I mean, there's a lot of an emphasis in this about how undesired Rachel Weisz's character feels. And I keep thinking to myself, it's Rachel Weisz, for goodness sake. I couldn't believe it. You know, she is incredibly desired.
Yeah, she is gorgeous. And I agree with you. I think that might be a slight flaw in the plan. I admire the boldness of the writing behind it, Scott, because it is trying to say this is the female gaze. We know an awful lot about the male gaze and what that does and why it's there. But we don't talk about the female gaze very much. But actually, for me, it goes a little bit too far. I feel quite uncomfortable watching her watching Vladimir. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I wonder, when I was watching this, how much of that uncomfortable feeling is actually intentional. And I think the reason why I was talking about half an hour episodes is that there were some times in which I felt like quite relieved that I was having time to breathe, which could be, in some retrospects, a good thing. I think what has been surprising about this drama is that it has been really rather divisive. And I also think, bizarrely, it's one of those shows in which it's not the only one that's looking at this divide between the different generations or looking at these sorts of relationships. There's, funnily enough, another show out this week called Rooster, which is done by the same people who made Ted Lasso. You can watch it on Sky, which also happens to feature a main character who's dealing with her daughter reeling after her partner was found to be having an affair with a student who was working at the university. So I think it's certainly ripe for material. I think just in the fact of Vladimir, it felt like something was missing. It had good elements, but I wasn't necessarily taken by the story and wanted to continue with it.
I completely agree. It's exactly how I felt about it too. Anybody who's watched it who wants to contribute something to the conversation, do feel free to ping us a message this afternoon. We'll move on to talk about Jonathan Ross's new show, Handcuffed, which asks the question, could you survive being handcuffed to a stranger 24/7? And Scott, we ask the question, why? Why?
I mean, it does feel like we're looking into a time capsule from the mid-noughties in terms of Channel 4 formats. I mean, I can sort of see the idea. I mean, it sort of fits the reality show format of trying to bridge the divide when we were in very polarising times. You know, they had, for example, someone who hates being referred to as babe. I mean, most people would, but one person who hates being referred to as babe, paired with somebody who just throws it into their lexicon without even thinking, plus also a person who loves going to the gym. The gym is their entire life, handcuffed next to a person who doesn't really care about that sort of lifestyle at all. So I think it's the fact that the frustration with me is that it tries to say, oh, it's a social experiment, we're going into this with good intentions. And then I keep thinking, no, not really. You're just wanting people to yell at each other and have a lot of arguments. And trust me, this show has it by the bucket load. It feels quite tonally different to a lot of sort of fly on the walls these days, which tend to be a lot more kind of, I would say, authentic in terms of being grounded rather than doing a sort of high stakes scenario. It feels like we're back in the era of Wife Swap or other sort of Channel 4 programs, which were trying to make people feel really frustrated more than anything.
Yeah.
And I think it's also the fact that the person who wins is the person who stays shackled to this other person the longest. So I'm not sure whether people are actually learning anything. They're just learning to put up with it.
Yes, exactly. Who's got the stamina and really, really wants the prize money? Do they genuinely have to stay handcuffed together all the time? I mean, are they, you know, seeing each other go to the loo, take a shower, literally everything that goes on in a life?
Yeah, I mean, that's what they imply from what you see in the opening titles. I mean, it literally starts with somebody having a shower and one person looking the other way, and made me feel a bit sympathetic towards the film crew. I think another big question mark is why Jonathan Ross is a part of this. And I'm quite surprised, because he seems to be very keen on it, and he has been talking about it a lot in the interviews, how he likes the format, including in the Times magazine. But no, it's not for me.
Yeah, let's just say no. The BBC has announced that it will be axing its reality TV series, I Kissed a Boy and I Kissed a Girl. It's a queer dating show that actually an awful lot of people have really enjoyed this, Scott. So what's the BBC said?
So the BBC said that they are ending this show just because of funding challenges. The show will have a series upcoming called I Kissed a Girl. But the series, which also features mostly gay men dating each other and the male counterpart, won't be returning for another series. Firstly, I think readdressed the balance that there had been in reality TV. I mean, it really hurt my head to find that until, I think, 2023, there hadn't been a same-sex dating show really in the UK before. I think some formats come close, like First Dates, or I think there was one MTV show that maybe dabbled back in the day. But for a public service broadcaster to put it in prime time, put Danny Minogue in it, who was really invested in it, it certainly felt like a breakthrough moment. I mean, I don't know how well it's been with ratings, but I mean, it's quite hard, I find, these days for most dating show formats, unless they're ludicrously expensive, successful, to last more than 3-4 years anyway. So it might have been, even though it has been a breakthrough, that it has sort of come to the end of its sort of natural life. What I hope it does is that it gives confidence to other dating sort of formats, to commissioners, to say, hang on, maybe we should explore having same-sex variations, because it used to be really quite binary. Like, even until if you look at Love Island, still they won't have same-sex pairings, because I remember an old ITV boss saying that it was logistically challenging. And I think for many LGBTQ plus people, they will be saying, really, am I a logistical challenge?
Yes. Why would it be?
Well, that's but on something like Love Island, isn't it? Because sometimes they do partner swaps and all of that kind of stuff. And I suppose, but the answer to that is just to have as many heterosexual couples and homosexual couples within the format, so you can do all those swaps and it works. I mean, it's not complicated, is it?
Yeah, and I think also I Kissed a Boy and I Kissed a Girl were very good at having casting that was representative across the UK, because I don't think they wanted to accidentally or incidentally imply that there is only one way to live a lifestyle. So, for example, you had the teen who grew up in Northern Ireland who hasn't really been dating somebody before, next to somebody who lived in Soho and went out every Saturday, next to sort of someone who maybe was halfway. And I found that it was certainly a lot more inclusive. And I think you only have to look at the success of, let's say, shows like The Traitors to realise, hang on, you can have people from all walks of life, from all backgrounds, and it adds to the show rather than takes away from it.
Scott, thank you very much indeed. A couple of quick messages from our listeners. Janie Joe's absolutely loved Vladimir. It's funny, witty, quirky, different, well acted. Get over yourselves. She does say, though, that Rachel Weisz is fabulous. She's not naturally gorgeous any longer due to the amount of work that she's had done. We don't know that for a fact, but I think we do, actually, if we watch it.
All right.
And Susan Edwards says the same thing, that Vladimir is excellent, Rachel Weisz at her beautiful, funny, sexiest best. There's a dark humour, but Leo Woodall needs to be careful. He might get typecast, she says.
What, as a gorgeous hunk?
Yes, as a little bit of younger distraction.
Right, yeah.
Be wary.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, 3 o'clock. And before we do anything else, if you did hear our A&E Dr. Rob Galloway talking about his charity a little bit earlier on, it's very easy to donate because it's such a worthwhile cause. It'll help all sorts of people all over the world with rare diseases. Get involved, just bung him a couple of quid. It's very easy. Just put into your favourite search engine, rare people, and it'll take you to the right place. You can do it in seconds. Right, it's now 3 o'clock. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio. Still to come, they've been out for an hour. We'll bring you what we know so far about the Mandelson files. Vassos Alexander has the sport, another dismal night for Spurs. And the author of Fast Food Nation, Eric Schlosser, joins us after 3:30. Here's the news at 3, James Kitchen.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. The Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister says Sir Keir Starmer takes full responsibility for appointing Peter Mandelson as ambassador to Washington, adding he should never have represented the UK. Darren Jones addressed MPs in the Commons as newly released files reveal the National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell, warned the appointment was weirdly rushed and unusual. Documents also show Sir Keir Starmer was told his former Director of Communications, Matthew Doyle, was satisfied with Peter Mandelson's explanation over his friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. The Times' policy editor is Oliver Wright.
Some of them talk about Mandelson's views on China, which he was quite favourable towards, the fact that his business had connections in Russia, all those kind of things, are uncomfortable for the government. You know, they are things which we broadly know before. But the point about this, I think, is that, you know, these are official documents telling Starmer this, warning him, and he went ahead with the appointment anyway. So I think that's where the political difficulty is.
The files reveal Lord Mandelson asked for more than £500,000 as a severance payment when he was sacked from the role in September last year. The former cabinet minister received £70,000 instead. Lord Mandelson also suggested that the prime minister could use Nigel Farage as a way to better UK connections with the Trump administration. The government says it's ordered an overhaul of standards in Whitehall to boost ethics and integrity in political and public life. Elsewhere, the 32 members of the International Energy Agency have agreed to their largest ever release of oil reserves in an effort to calm markets reacting to the Iran war. The IEA, which includes the UK and US, will release 400 million barrels. It has more than a billion barrels in reserve. The move comes after three commercial ships were damaged by unknown projectiles in the Strait of Hormuz. Meanwhile, the Home Secretary has confirmed the ban on the Al-Quds Day march in London will last a month. Shabana Mahmood said the Iran conflict had created clear challenges for police, arguing officers can't guarantee the capital's safety without a ban. Earlier, the Islamic Human Rights Commission, which is behind the protest, said it will go ahead on Sunday as a static demonstration. Addressing MPs this afternoon, the Home Secretary insisted the restrictions were limited and specific.
Peaceful and lawful protest, whether for Palestine or for Israel or for any other cause, must be cherished and protected, and this government will always defend that sacred freedom. At the same time, as Home Secretary, I have a solemn duty, and it is my first duty, to keep the British people safe.
The government has lost its appeal over a terror charge against a member of the Irish language rap trio Kneecap. Liam O'Hanley had been accused of showing support for the proscribed organisation Hezbollah following a gig in London in 2024. Last year, the case was thrown out over a legal timing issue, but the government appealed the decision. A prisoner's appeared in court charged with murdering Ian Huntley in a maximum security jail. Anthony Russell, who's 43, is accused of killing the Soham murderer in HMP Frankland in Durham last month. The 52-year-old, who was serving a life sentence for the 2002 murders of 10-year-olds Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman, was reportedly beaten with a metal bar. Russell will appear at Newcastle Crown Court tomorrow morning. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. Keir Starmer says he takes responsibility for the appointment of Peter Mandelson as British ambassador to the US. That statement actually came not from Keir Starmer, but from Darren Jones, who's chief secretary to the PM. He was speaking this afternoon after the release of documents relating to Mandelson's appointment.
The Prime Minister has taken responsibility for Peter Mandelson's appointment as ambassador to the United States. He has acknowledged it was a mistake and has apologised, not least for believing Peter Mandelson's lies. As the government has said previously, there are specific documents that this government would like to have been able to disclose today, but which the Metropolitan Police have asked us not to do so yet, in order to avoid prejudicing their ongoing criminal investigation into Peter Mandelson. We have agreed to that request.
So Mandelson, of course, sacked from that role in the States after revelations about the true extent of his friendship with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Well, this is only the very first instalment. The Times newsroom reporter Ollie Cole has more on what's been released so far. So, Ollie, you've had about an hour and 10 minutes. What do you know?
Well, there's plenty in there. Essentially, what we're learning is that The Prime Minister, the team around the Prime Minister, when it came to this appointment, knew exactly what the rest of us all knew about Peter Mandelson, and was, he claims, lied to when asked about links with Epstein, but continued to go ahead with his appointment anyway. So we get this due diligence report from Inside Number 10, which does make reference to the links to Epstein by Peter Mandelson. We have in it the findings of an internal report by JP Morgan over Mandelson's reputation and association with Epstein. And we also have reporting more widely from the British press about those things. And with it, there's a note that says general reputational risk. Now, we understand from these documents that a few questions were drawn up after a conversation between Keir Starmer's Director of Communications at the time, Matthew Doyle, and Morgan McSweeney, who's then Chief of Staff. And three questions were put to Peter Mandelson. Those answers are the ones that the Prime Minister said Peter Mandelson lied in. But it clearly shows that, you know, there was a reputational risk flagged at the time of his appointment. Links to Epstein were flagged at the time of his appointment. His views on China, his company Global Council, were also drawn up in this due diligence report. And the difficulty politically is that the Prime Minister's position essentially seems to be that he trusted the answers that Mandelson gave to those three questions over the reporting by the British press, a 2019 report by JP Morgan, reporting by other journalists at the time, and that internal note which said it caused a general reputational risk. So there is still a lot of questions to answer, more files to come out, but essentially we now know that at the time this document was handed to the Prime Minister, and he went ahead with that appointment in spite of it.
Okay, and lots of eye-watering detail about the payoff that Mandelson wanted.
Yeah, I mean, as interesting as the appointment itself is the sort of documentation around after Peter Mandelson was told he no longer has the job. He wanted £500,000 as a payout. He wanted pay in lieu of the rest of his term that was supposed to be in Washington, so says these documents. And the government have said they got that down to £75,000. They say that a payout of that size was seen as reasonable because there was a possibility of an employment tribunal that Peter Mandelson might have taken them to court. There would have been legal costs incurred. Justin Madders, a Labour MP, a Labour backbencher, has pointed out, in fact, in the Commons that, you know, if it was found in that possible tribunal that Peter Mandelson had lied in those answers, how much of a leg would have had to stand on. But that is the payout that was seen. There was also questions over once the Department of Justice had released in the US more Epstein files, the request for a daily check-in on the welfare of Peter Mandelson after he'd been out of post. And there were also calls to those around Starmer to find out what they knew at the time. The one person who sort of comes out not bad from this is the National Security Advisor Jonathan Powell, who served as Chief of Staff to Tony Blair while Peter Mandelson was a Labour minister. And apparently he noted at the time that this seemed a bit rushed. He wasn't quite sure on the appointment itself, wasn't sure what should go ahead and why it was going ahead. So we're getting a real insight into the inner workings here, both through notes from phone calls, from emails, and, you know, we know there is lots more to come.
OK, but that's quite significant, isn't it, that the Jonathan Powell, who is still the National Security Advisor, he wasn't very certain about this. He alone expressed disquiet, or was he one of a number of people who wasn't entirely sure it was a good idea?
From these documents, it seems he alone. There's a call between Mike Ostermar, the General Counsel to the Prime Minister, and Jonathan Powell on the 12th of September 2025. So it's just after we learned about Mandelson's further links with Epstein from Bloomberg. And Jonathan Powell says he found the appointment process unusual, weirdly rushed. Doesn't recall any specific meetings on this that he was involved in, but had a few conversations. He raised concerns about Peter Mandelson and his reputation to Morgan McSweeney, who was, of course, then the Chief of Staff. And Morgan McSweeney responded, Powell says, that the issues had been addressed. So, you know, this really goes to the heart of the political judgment within Downing Street. The political judgment essentially has to be made by the Prime Minister, and why he, as a former chief prosecutor in this country, decided to believe Peter Mandelson's answers to those three questions while concerns were raised, and instead didn't believe the reporting by journalists, an internal review by JP Morgan, and that note that was handed to him.
Right. I mean, Mandelson's gone, McSweeney's gone, the Prime Minister's still there. I suppose that's... yeah. There was a potential meeting in these files between Epstein and Tony Blair. And this is when Tony Blair was the Prime Minister.
Yeah, that's right. So essentially, part of these files and part of the due diligence report that was sent to the Prime Minister included a note from the Cabinet Office, an email from Peter Mandelson during his time under Blair's administration, basically trying to set up a meeting between Jeffrey Epstein and the then Prime Minister, saying that Epstein knew Bill Clinton fairly well and Clinton wanted something arranged in terms of a meeting. He was a big shot financier, etc., etc. And so there was flagged in this documentation that was handed to the Prime Minister that this email, this correspondence, would essentially come out at some point. It would have to come out as part of the National Archives. And so a copy of it was sent to the Prime Minister. And there's a sticky note on it saying that it wouldn't be coming out until after the appointment was made. But we can now read, obviously, how, you know, deep those connections between Mandelson and Epstein were, how he attempted to bring Epstein into the influence and the sphere of Number 10 back when Tony Blair was Prime Minister. And obviously, you know, we now know that with a police investigation going on, in which Peter Mandelson denies doing anything for financial gain, we know that that relationship had a long tail, and we know that that relationship continued far beyond Mandelson's time at Cabinet and right through.
Thank you, Ollie, very much. That's Ollie Cole, who is our newsroom reporter here at Times Radio. He's done a good job there, ploughing through what we know so far.
And the constantly updated page that you're after is at thetimes.com. It is being updated every 5 minutes or so as our journalists work through those files. 12 minutes past three, 8 months after applying for British citizenship, a Hong Kong pro-democracy activist with £100,000 bounty on his head says the UK government is still deciding whether or not he's of good character. Finn Lau was involved in the 2019 protest against Beijing's rule in Hong Kong and is wanted under the territory's national security laws. He fears that the activism that forced him to flee could now count against him. And he joins us now. Finn, very good afternoon from us. Just tell us a little bit more about when you applied for British citizenship and what the latest is that you know about the progress of that application.
Yeah, so to provide maybe a little bit background, so I came to the UK as a skilled worker using the Tier 2 working visa, and then I switched to the BNO visa back in 2021, which is a visa that is dedicated for the Hong Kong people who was born before 1997 Hong Kong handover. And then I applied for my citizenship back in June last year. And in theory, all the applications should be processed within 6 months from the application. But in my case, it's clearly longer than that.
How do you know that the delay in processing your application might be to do with any character reference that has come from your activities in Hong Kong?
So first of all, we could look at other benchmarks. For example, in the same period, like maybe some other Hong Kong application, or maybe some application from Taiwanese, their application was approved and processed within 2 to 3 months. But in my case, it is clearly longer than that, although it is in the same period. So we could take the so-called administration workload factor aside. On the other hand, from the latest reply from the Home Office, which was around 10 days ago, they finally say something related to the good character check. This is the first time they provide maybe a little bit explanation, so-called explanation, to my application delay. Previously, they just said that, some application may take longer than 6 months, but this time, this is the first time that they said, there may be some good character check that is still in place, and is taking longer than usual.
Sure. So, Finn, why would your protesting in Hong Kong, which was protesting pro-democracy, why would that show up in some bad way, some sinister way, in a character reference? It is the reason why so many people have applied for citizenship in this country from Hong Kong.
So first of all, political oppression is the key factor that we got almost 200,000 Hong Kongers relocating from Hong Kong to the UK since 2021. And then in my case, I have been named as one of the, defendants or one of the targets in the, flagship or landmark case of Jimmy Lai. So Jimmy Lai is a British citizen, a Hong Kong tycoon who got persecuted by the Hong Kong authority as well as the Beijing regime for a number of so-called crimes like looting reform forces, although what he did and what I did was simply fighting for freedom, advocating for freedom and democracy in Hong Kong. So in my case, my name has been mentioned in that court case for over 200 times. I also got a bounty from the Hong Kong authority, which is, you have mentioned that it is 100,000 pounds. So I have been facing lots of different transnational repression coming from the Beijing regime as well as the Hong Kong authorities. But all of this could be counted as so-called criminal records under the current Home Office regime or the so-called standard. So it is quite ironic to see that on the one hand, the Hong Kong, the UK government pledged to provide protection and honour the promises towards Hong Kong people. But on the other hand, on the ground, all of the, well, bureaucracy or maybe even other factors are preventing Hong Kongers from settling down in the UK.
Sure. Can you explain to us just a little bit about the territory's national security laws and what they actually mean and how you can fall foul of them?
So the first thing is that the Hong Kong national security law is totally different from the one in the UK. So in Hong Kong, there was a law that's directly promulgated by the Beijing regime by passing the Legislative Council in Hong Kong back in 2020 in June. So at that time, since then, all the advocacy for democracy, freedom, civil liberties, or even rule of law could be considered as a cession to the regime. You could be, even though just like right now I'm speaking to the Times Radio, but then this is considered or regarded as colluding reform forces. So there are a large area of legal activities being criminalized in Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, there is no independent judicial system anymore after the enactment of such Hong Kong national security law. So that's why the Hong Kong, the joint declaration over Hong Kong between China and the British regime, has been breached completely. So there is a situation and reality.
Sure. So, Finn, do you believe that you have done anything that were you to have done that in this country, you would have fallen foul of our laws too? Because that's the key point here, isn't it?
Yeah, not at all. Because, we have seen a number, actually more than a dozen of different written verbal statements coming from the Home Office or even the Foreign Office or even sometimes from the Prime Minister regarding these cases that I got involved in. If what I faced are considered as criminal or criminalized here, then, they should not have issued such a statement. Yeah, so this is, totally opposite to what they have said in those public statements.
If your case has been delayed or if, in fact, you are denied British citizenship because of a poor character reference, because you are wanted under those national security laws, do you believe that that would be Britain changing its attitudes to protest and actually changing its attitudes to China?
So there are wider implications towards my case. So if my case got rejected in the end, that means, the trust of Hong Kongers towards the UK government, especially the Labour government, would be completely undermined by the action of the Home Office. On the other hand, we could no longer place our trust towards the Labour government regarding tackling transnational repression, even spying activities coming from Beijing. So these are some applications.
Finn, it's very good to talk to you. Keep us posted on your case. That's Finn Lau. He's applied for British citizenship. And as you heard at the beginning of the interview, there does appear to be a delay in the processing of that application, which Finn believes is down to the fact that he has demonstrated for democracy in Hong Kong and therefore broken the national security laws there. Many of you on this programme and listening to this radio station will be very familiar with the case of Jimmy Lai. He fell foul massively of those same national security laws but is not regarded as a criminal in this country at all.
No, it does seem bizarre, that, doesn't it? This is Times Radio. There is some breaking sports news this afternoon about the World Cup. There'll be more with Vassos Alexander in a moment. It is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
Prepare for a lively mix of illuminating conversation, telling the stories that matter, alongside a world-class lineup of guests, experts and contributors. There's a merry band of erudite intellectuals who join us every evening. Michael Binion.
We had a very interesting meeting with the Russian Orthodox Patriarch.
Zoe Strimple.
There is real unease.
And Peter Hitchens, to name a few.
This is war, for goodness sake. Nobody tells the truth about what's going on.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
Hello, Greg James here.
And I'm Seema Pankhania.
And we're the hosts of the Tesco Kitchen.
Every week, Greg and I invite a culinary powerhouse into the kitchen to cook a recipe that really means something to them.
Hold on to your hairnets, because this week we're joined by chef, musician and host of Big Zoo's Big Eats. You might have guessed it, it's Big Zoo.
Zoo is taking us on a trip down memory lane and showing us how to cook the lasagna that changed his life forever.
It's live right now on YouTube, so get involved.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Vassos Alexander is here. He's a slick person who's arrived wearing his wife's glasses today.
Just in all seriousness, do you want to try mine?
No one can see. Good grief, woman. Look, you're battling on and we're very impressed.
It's really weird. If you look through somebody else's glasses, yes, and then you take them off, you feel a little bit dizzy.
But you know, it's a
and I do need them. Unfortunately, I've reached that sort of age where I couldn't read this copy from the Times online without the glasses. So I will battle on.
Good on message statement. That I liked it. It's just sometimes philosophically just worth acknowledging.
He doesn't realise he's actually got the Guardian there.
That you need to see the world through somebody else's glasses. I wish I hadn't started that. Right. It wasn't worth the bother, was it? Now, breaking sports news about the World Cup. I mean, it's not entirely unexpected, but tell us.
So this is Iran's sports minister who has said the country will not participate in the 2026 World Cup. I think he'd said something similar a week ago, but he said it much more forcefully now. Here's the quote. Considering that this corrupt regime, the US, has assassinated our leader, under no circumstances can we participate in the World Cup. Gianni Infantino, the head of FIFA, has said recently that it's up to Iran whether they want to compete in the World Cup. If they don't, then it's entirely up to FIFA to decide who will replace them.
OK. I mean, which countries are in line to replace them?
I would expect strongly that it would either be Iraq or the United Arab Emirates, who both lost out in the qualification playoffs to Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Yeah. Maybe a playoff between Iraq and UAE.
Right. It's just worth saying, I'm sure we can all remember those images of the Iranian women's football team heading back to Iran, and you really do wish them all the best. Not quite sure what awaits them when they get back. Right, let's move on to the much more cheery subject of Tottenham Hotspur. Now, last night, they were 4 goals down after 22 minutes in the Champions League. Their eventual 5-2 defeat by Atletico Madrid is described in the Times today as brutal, farcical and a total demolition. Let's indulge ourselves even more. Here's how some of the goals sounded over on TalkSport.
Oh, a terrible mistake from Kinski. He's lost possession inside the penalty area. It's Rob Square and Llorente fires it in to the bottom left-hand corner. Oh, another stumble. They're in again. It's Griezmann trying to get round Danso. Slots it into the bottom right-hand corner. Twice, Spurs have lost their footing.
Spurs fans must be thinking, I cannot believe what I'm watching and listening to here.
Oh, he's done it again, Kinski. He's going to be walked in for three. And he lies face down in the turf. And Spurs are already beaten.
We've all had a bad day at work, and that was a shocking day for the Spurs goalkeeper, who was taken off, wasn't he?
Yeah, I've genuinely never seen anything like it. Neither heard like Jim Proudfoot, who you heard commentating there, or anyone watching that match. This is a 22-year-old kid.
Very sad, actually.
Antonin Kinski. Yeah. Yes, it's sort of like, OK, Spurs are imploding, and if you're not a Spurs fan, there's a certain schadenfreude to be enjoyed there, but not because you just feel so bad for this. So he slipped twice. The first and third goals were entirely his fault. He slipped as he was passing. And, you know, I've been listening to the pundits. They say, stop Stop telling these. He's playing his third game for Spurs. The first two have been in the League Cup. This is suddenly a Champions League knockout game in a cauldron in Madrid. So just, if you get the ball, just put your laces through it. Don't try and play out from the back. Because, you know, just get yourself in the game. And he wasn't allowed to do that. He didn't do that. He slipped twice. It's awful. It's comical. And
when a professional sports person slips, because we all slip, don't we? Is it their fault? Is it the turf? What is it? Is it their shoes?
If you wear traditional studs, then it's much harder to slip.
Yeah.
The boots with the moulded studs at the bottom are much more comfortable and players prefer that. But then you are much more liable to slip. Okay. So some managers will say, if you slip, it's your fault. Just wear the proper boots, for goodness sake. It doesn't matter about comfort. You're on the pitch for 90 minutes. This kid, he had his head in his hands that second time he slipped and Atletico went in for 3-0. Then he was substituted after 17 minutes, which is incredibly harsh. And Igor Tudor, the Spurs interim manager, the guy who they brought in for an instant impact, his impact is 4 defeats from 4. 5-2, by the way, was an absolute victory for Spurs, given that they were 4-0 down in 22 minutes and you were thinking this could be double figures, this could be anything.
It's only the first leg of this.
I mean, you know, who knows? Maybe Spurs will go through. That would be quite a Spursy thing to do, to be honest.
Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah. But he didn't acknowledge the keeper as he came off. A couple of the Spurs players, even the Atletico Madrid fans in the stadium, gave him a sort of sympathetic round of applause as he went down. And you'd imagine the guy was in tears in the dressing room. Some of the Spurs players, and Pedro Porro, I think, and Romero, did just give him a tap on the back and say, look, you know, it's all right. But it's very difficult to come back from that. Okay. If you're that keeper.
Right.
And if you're Spurs.
And if you're Spurs, yeah. Tudor, this man, Igor Tudor. He's Croatian, isn't he? Mm-hmm. He's not going to be around for much longer.
Imagine not. Spurs have said this afternoon that he will do the media ahead of Sunday's match at Anfield. So that would be, Thursday or Friday? Maybe they'll get the Liverpool away match out of the way and then think about a replacement. But, you know, I'd heard that he'd sort of lost the dressing room after match two, which was away at Fulham. And he gave them the full-on hairdryer treatment there. Since then, they've lost to Crystal Palace from a winning position. And then last night, it was an absolute low. And they are, make no mistake, Spurs, you know, despite the £1 billion stadium, they are 1 point off the relegation zone. They're the only team in the Premier League not to win all year. They are bang in trouble. Can you imagine? The Spurs fans on their way back from the game last night in the Metro in Madrid were singing Lincoln away, ole ole, in a sort of self-mocking way, which, fair play to them.
And hard on Lincoln, can I say. Right, let's go racing.
Cheltenham Festival Update on Times Radio with Ladbrokes. We bring daily free bets for Cheltenham. That's Laddisfaction. 18 plus, gambleaware.org.
What's been going on today?
So today is Queen Mother Champion Chase Day. It hasn't happened yet. It happens in exactly half an hour's time. And Margeborough is being heavily tipped in the Times today to do the business. Threw away victory in the Arkle Trophy last year after almost falling two out and then sort of ploughing through the last fence. So 7-1, Queen Mother Champion Chase at 4 o'clock. Margeborough is well fancied. I've quite enjoyed. Have you heard about the Costa del Cheltenham?
Go on.
So a lot of punters are swapping the sort of the Cheltenham roar for, what are they calling it, the Benidorm bellow, and flying to the Costa Blanca, yes, to watch the racing in their thousands. This started a couple of years ago, but it's really taken off this year. According to one of the travel companies, bookings are 225% up on what they were for Cheltenham last year.
So presumably it's a toasty 23 Celsius in Benidorm?
Yeah, bit of sunshine, cheaper booze, cheaper food. You still get the atmosphere because there's so many people going. And, and
lucky
so loads,
Spain.
Loads of people.
What you're saying, Murphy.
To watch the racing in Benidorm.
Right, okay.
Willie Mullins, by the way, has had two winners this afternoon so far at 11-1, both of them. So good afternoon for him.
Well, I've just checked. It's raining and it's 16 Celsius in Benidorm. But looking better tomorrow and up to 19 on Friday. Vassos, thank you very much.
Cheltenham Festival Update on Times Radio with Ladbrokes. We bring daily free bets for Cheltenham. That's Laddisfaction. 18 plus, gambleaware.org.
Well, I think he did very well with his wife's glasses. Do you know how she's doing with yours?
That is a good question.
We'll check in with her, man. Yeah. Coming up, what was and is behind the Happy Meal? We're going to talk to writer and journalist Eric Schlosser about 25 years since he wrote his seminal book, Fast Food Nation. It's all after the latest news headlines with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. It's emerged Sir Keir Starmer was warned that appointing Peter Mandelson as ambassador to the US could be a reputational risk. Newly released files show the National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell, warned the appointment was weirdly rushed and unusual. The documents also reveal Lord Mandelson asked for more than £500,000 as a severance payment when he was sacked from the role in September last year. The former cabinet minister received £70,000 instead. The Times newsroom reporter Ollie Cole says the files are providing an insight into the Prime Minister's decision-making.
There is a difficulty here that we shouldn't apply too much hindsight. Obviously, we've had a lot of Department of Justice documents from the US to look through over the last sort of couple of months, and we know a lot more now than we did then. But this document will already lay out what was known about that relationship, and it goes to the heart of Keir Starmer's judgment and the people around him's judgment.
The High Court has ruled the kneecap rapper Liam O'Hanna won't face trial after being accused of showing support for the proscribed organisation Hezbollah following a gig in London in 2024. Judges rejected an appeal by the Crown Prosecution Service against the decision to throw out the case. A prisoner's appeared in court charged with murdering Ian Huntley in a maximum security jail. Anthony Russell, who's 43, is accused of killing the Soham murderer in HMP Frankland in Durham last month. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Sorry to interrupt your day, but I've just been diagnosed with dementia and I'm going to need your help. I'll need help when I can no longer button a shirt or recognise my own family. My daughter will need help too. I worry this could ruin her life. And we will all need help to find a cure to end the devastation of dementia. I can't do this alone.
It will take a society to beat dementia. Alzheimer's Society.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. There's over 80 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the Spend and Save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wickes.co.uk.
Now, a coquettish Marilyn Monroe looks out at you from the front cover of Eric Schlosser's seminal book, Fast Food Nation. She's about to tuck into a burger served to her in her car at a drive-thru. It was the American dream on a tray, tasty food for the masses, served at a time and a price that suited the customer. But it had a dark side, and when Eric Schlosser first published his book 25 years ago, he shone a light behind the serving hatch, one that revealed whole industries of yuck. From the child labour in food packing factories to the horrendous safety standards of some abattoirs and meat production houses to the lack of animal welfare on huge dairy farms. All the way through, he detailed what lay behind the arches, the secret recipes, the wholesome Wendy-style image of American fast food. To celebrate 25 years since then, it has been republished with a new chapter at the end, and you would hope that we've made progress. Eric joined us from the States. I asked him where he was in his own life when he first started writing Fast Food Nation 25 years ago.
I was like so many other people in the sense that I ate this food without ever thinking about it. I travel a lot for my work, and it was just incredibly convenient to go to McDonald's, grab something quickly. And I had small children, and I took them to McDonald's, and I never really thought about it. And the editor of Rolling Stone asked me to write a piece on the fast food industry and go behind the counter and show where this food comes from and how it's made. And I didn't jump at the assignment because I didn't want to write something that was condescending and put down this food because I ate it. And I said I'd think about it. And I started researching the industry. And I was amazed at how quickly our food system, and this, when I say our, not just the American, but throughout the West, how quickly the food system had been changed without any of us really seeing it or understanding it. And the reason is the food looks the same, but it was being produced in a whole new way. This gigantic fast food industrial system had arisen behind the scenes. And so that's what made me write it. It wasn't to attack hamburgers and French fries. It was to show, you know, where we're eating, where it comes from, and the impact that is sort of invisible.
And tell us a little bit more about all of those things that you found, because it's so fascinating, isn't it? The food that comes through the hatch to us as the customer, It actually tells you so little about what's happening in meat production, packaging factories, in abattoirs, in dairy farms. I mean, this is a completely hidden world to most of us, isn't it?
It is. And you know, I have gotten this reputation as a food writer, but people who know me well just know I am the worst cook that you could possibly imagine. And I'm not a foodie in the classical sense of, you know, really comparing different olive oils for their aroma and their flavor sense. I got involved in food issues by spending a year following the harvest in California with strawberry workers. And it was a way of showing before Fast Food Nation where our food comes from, because there had been a huge increase in strawberry production in the United States. And I'm in California right now, and California grows most of the strawberries that Americans eat. But every one of those strawberries needs to be picked carefully by hand, because strawberries bruise so easily. So if you're going to have tons and tons of strawberries, you need lots of hands of poor migrant workers to harvest them. And the same is true in the United Kingdom, you know, for your strawberries. So with that article on the strawberry industry, I was trying to show what goes into bringing you this very simple food. And with Fast Food Nation, I did the same. And what was so shocking to me, and one of the reasons that I took this Rolling Stone article and I turned it into a book, was when I went into the slaughterhouses, I met people, in some cases, who had been migrant farm workers in California. And this, you know, the same people were doing this terrible, terrible work in American slaughterhouses, this brutal, dangerous work. There's a very famous American novel called The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. It was published in 1906, and it was about the brutality of the meatpacking industry as a way of looking at the brutality of the American capitalism of his age. You know, there was child labor, there was a 6-day work week, people worked 10 hours a day. If you got injured, you got fired. And that book really resonated with me, because after The Jungle was published in 1906, the meatpacking industry eventually was reformed, and being a meatpacking worker became a really high-paid middle-class job. You know, it was a union job. It was like being an auto worker. But by the time I came to write Fast Food Nation, the unions had been wrecked, driven out of the plants, and it had become an incredibly dangerous, low-wage job, much like the farm workers that I'd written about years earlier. Mm-hmm. So, again, I'm not trying to scold people. I'm not trying to tell people what to eat. I have no moral superiority whatsoever on that level. But what I'm trying to do with these things that I've written about food is show where your food comes from and what the consequences are of buying certain foods, not just for yourself and your health, but also for the rest of society.
So the book told us so much about the huge power of these big food corporations. It told us about animal welfare, as you've mentioned. It told us about working conditions within the food chain. Remind us of what the reaction of all of those vested interests was to you when the book came out.
You know, they really didn't like the book. And I was personally, you know, attacked by the big food companies. And you know, it just shows, despite being so powerful, how thin-skinned they really are to this day. I mean, as a writer and someone who writes books, you know, you get bad reviews. But I don't attack and, you know, go after and wait outside the house of book critics because they don't like my book. And yet, here you have companies, McDonald's, for example, that spends $1 billion a year on advertising and marketing. And I can tell you that the marketing budget for Fast Food Nation was significantly less than that. And it was really stressful because when I would appear in public, there were often demonstrators who would try to disrupt my talks. There were threats made against me. And it was clear that this was being organized because in different cities, the pamphlets attacking me would be exactly the same, except at the top, the name of the group in the city would be different. And, you know, I'm not one of these people who's looking for this kind of, you know, like tabloid shouting at one another on TV. I'm pretty chill. The book sort of speaks for itself. And yet there was real pushback against it. Having said that, I'm extraordinarily fortunate that it was published the way that I wrote it. I didn't have to change anything for legal reasons. And my God, it's in print 25 years later. So I ultimately, as a writer, have nothing to complain about. But it was interesting to see how savage these companies could be just for the slightest criticism and really wouldn't engage in any dialogue with me, but just came up with all kinds of ways to attack me.
One of the ways that they attacked you is they kind of wanted to portray you as being a po-faced socialist, didn't they, in a world of the happy capitalist. And, I mean, there is an argument, Eric, that, you know, we as consumers are driving that industry because we like our fast food, we want our chicken crunchy, we want to eat lots of meat, we're happy it's all fried. And so who are you to come along and say, there's a bit of an aftertaste going on there?
Yeah. Well, the kind of economic system that we have right now would be very difficult for Adam Smith, the great proponent of capitalism, to recognize. I mean, Adam Smith and the founders of the United States were very much anti-monopoly. When you have incredible power over a market, that's really the opposite of capitalism. And one of the things that Fast Food Nation did and the afterword that I recently wrote for it is show how one sector of our economy, and especially in the food industry, has been taken over by just a handful of companies that don't really, really compete. And it's true that consumers have an enormous amount of power over the industry, but when you look at, and I love Penguin UK, which has just been extraordinary as a publisher for me, but their advertising for my book isn't quite $1 billion a year. So when you're in the realm of public opinion, it isn't really a fair fight. But I think of all the purchases that we make, you know, food is one of the most important, not only for your own health, but for the health of your family and the health of your society. And I think it bears a little more thought than we've given to it previously. One of the encouraging things that's happened in the last 25 years is that a whole new food system has arisen in opposition to the fast food system. You know, there are farmers markets, there's organic food, there's much more interest in sustainable, regenerative agriculture. But what you see is that food is really available to the wealthy and people who are well-educated. A lot of it is about, do you have access to good, healthy food? And do you have access to the knowledge that'll encourage you to choose it? And too often you see the people who are eating the most unhealthy food are the people who can least afford it and are going to suffer the worst consequences from it.
And so, Eric, when you wrote the book 25 years ago, you know, if you could have cast your mind forward to us having this conversation now, you can't possibly have wanted the world of food to still be exactly as you've just described it, good for the minority at the top of the pile and still pretty poor for most people further down.
Yeah, I the egomaniac in me would have just been delighted that the book is still in print 25 years later, but I would have wanted it to be more of a historical work that people read to look at how people were eating at the end of the 20th, beginning of the 21st century, and kind of remarking it, wow, that's, you know, like reading Roman history and all the strange things they ate in their great banquets. I would have liked it to have been a work of history.
And who's to blame for that? Because if in 2026, the people that you've talked about already, you know, working in the meatpacking factory, in the slaughterhouse, on the massive dairy farm, I mean, if they're no better off now than they were back then, is it
government? Is it legislation? Is it the consumer? Why hasn't there been change?
Well, to give a local context, the Labour Party, looking at the history of the Labour Party, it was founded to help the workers of the United Kingdom. And yet when I was writing Fast Food Nation, the Labour Party was being sponsored by the McDonald's Corporation, and simply because McDonald's was donating so much money to Labour. So one of the sad truths is that the political systems of both of our countries have been so corrupted by money, it's just beyond belief. And I'm not even getting into the scandals with the Republican Party and the Tories. So firstly is the corruption of government by money. And these big corporations have much more money than migrant farm workers and meatpacking workers. Mm. And the second is, what I was alluding to earlier, the disproportionate ability of these companies to get their point of view across versus their critics. So, we're talking billions of dollars in advertising and marketing. It's not entirely a fair fight. One of the things that's really sad right now is all these weight loss drugs that people are taking. It's a sign of how hard it is to change your eating habits that you need to take a drug that's going to help you lose weight and a drug that you'll probably have to be on for the rest of your life in order for that weight loss to stick.
Yeah.
So what we really need to do is to prevent people from becoming unhealthy in the first place. And I think this industry bears enormous responsibility for the poor health of adults, but especially for the poor health of the children in the United States and the United Kingdom. Because once you become obese and by the age of 12 or 13, it's very, very difficult to lose that weight. It doesn't mean that you're doomed to it. It just means it's really hard once you emerge from childhood as severely overweight or
sure.
obese.
Let's talk about the now. And I think probably I would know the answer to a question that asked for your opinion about President Trump and his diet. So we might park that in obvious corner. But yeah. I do want to ask you about the Secretary of Health and Human Services, to give him his full title, Robert F. Yeah. Kennedy Jr. And I'll quote a bit from the book for our listeners. Yeah. RFK Jr. has made a series of misleading claims about AIDS, measles, vaccines, COVID-19, autism, Tylenol, antidepressants, fluorinated water, the role of germs in causing disease, chemtrails, 9/11, and how a dead bear cub once wound up in New York City's Central Park. But Kennedy's political instincts about food have been astute. His endorsement most likely won Trump the presidency in 2024, and his influence has turned right-wing pundits like Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck, who ridiculed Michelle Obama's efforts to promote exercise and healthy eating, into cheerleaders for those same policies. Help us understand what's going on there.
Well, I'll give you the hopeful aspect of it. The hopeful part of it is that in the United States, and I believe in the United Kingdom as well, there is enormous popular support for healthy food, especially for children. And Bobby Kennedy, to his credit, had the political instinct and the nerve to say that out loud. And I've been involved in the United States working with senators and congressmen for years on these issues, and it's been remarkable how cowardly both political parties have been in taking on these big food companies. So Bobby Kennedy said out loud this truth, and Donald Trump has kept on long because Bobby Kennedy brought maybe 4%, 5% of the vote with him, mainly white suburban mothers. So that's the good part about Bobby Kennedy. The bad part is he's like a broken clock. He's right twice a day and he's wrong for the other 23 hours and 59 minutes. I mean, I personally think he's a terrible human being, and that thousands of Americans, maybe many of them children, are going to die because of his anti-science absurd beliefs. But what's almost like a hallucination for me is he gets out on the campaign trail and he starts using language that could have been in Fast Food Nation or in Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma. And he uses these slogans that the food movement, that is the movement, bring healthy, sustainable food to the world, he uses the slogans, and behind it is the Trump administration, which is cutting spending on food safety, which is cutting regulations on pesticides, which is, you know, destroying the public health system of the United States. So the good news is there is a well of popular support for changing this system. The bad news is right now that movement in the United States is being led by a total con man.
Let's try and end on a positive note, Eric, but yes. I'm not sure whether or not it is possible to do so.
It is. And I thank you for giving me the opportunity to end on it, because I would not have written this book and I wouldn't have returned to it 25 years later and written a new chapter if I thought all is lost and doom and gloom and woe is me. What's striking to me is that things don't have to be this way. And I've seen people change their diets. I've seen really good changes. And it gets back to what we were talking about before. You know, if you are in London and you are wealthy, you are going to eat extremely well and have a Pilates class and be fit as can be. And there's a certain segment of the population that has changed its eating habits that is fit and healthy and is going to have a long life. And we need to bring that opportunity to everybody. And it's totally possible. Just, you know, on the meat stuff, we've been eating meat as a society for thousands and thousands of years, but we've never eaten meat that's produced with such systematic cruelty to the animals and cruelty to the workers and destruction of the environment. So we can change things, and it's totally possible. But the first step to changing them is being aware of what the problem is. That's what I try to do with my work.
Might there be a possibility, Eric, that the GLP-1 drugs, which do seem to change people's appetites, not just as an appetite suppressant, but actually what they want to eat, and anecdotally, an awful lot of people say they just don't want the junk food anymore. They do want to reach for something a bit more nutrient dense and better for them. Is there a terrible irony galloping across the horizon that actually it might be Big Pharma that sorts out the problems of big food in the end?
Well, I want to be clear about these drugs. There are some people for whom these drugs are literally a lifesaver. They are severely obese. They are at high risk of diabetes. They're finding a long list of health benefits from taking these drugs. So I'm not opposed to these drugs. At the same time, I happen to believe it's possible to live a healthy life without having to take these drugs for the rest of your life. The social cost of these drugs is tens of billions of dollars a year. And sadly, you know, we don't know necessarily what the long-term effects of taking these drugs. So for certain people, these drugs are absolutely amazing. For Hollywood actors who want to lose maybe an extra 4 pounds so that their, you know, their cheekbones are more prominent on screen, I don't know that these drugs are worth taking by people who really don't need them. One of the main themes of the book, we introduce these technologies that create problems, and then we find a new technology to solve them that creates different problems. And maybe there's a way as society, not just in the United States, but in the United Kingdom, that we can produce food that's healthy in a sustainable way and make sure that people have enough money to buy it and enough free time so that they can exercise. And maybe we wouldn't need the pharma industry to solve problems that, you know, we did not have an obesity epidemic in the United States till the 1980s or in the United Kingdom. So these are recent problems that I think can be solved without having to rely on a new technology or on a powerful drug that maybe people don't need.
Eric Schlosser, and the book is Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. It is reprinted, republished with an extra chapter at the end. Jan says, I've won. I'm very grateful for the work this author does. I worry a lot about animal welfare regarding food. We always have free-range chicken, but recently I've heard bad things about the way they are treated, so I'm now worrying about this. Should I be? Well, probably, Jan. I think you're onto something there. And Charlie says, another food issue that could be exposed is bread. It was Real Bread Week recently. That passed us by, didn't it?
I find it hard to believe.
Well, every week is Bread Week for you.
Certainly. Indeed.
And Charlie says they are quite rightly disparaging about most supermarket loaves. Bread only needs four ingredients: flour, water, salt and yeast. But if you look at the ingredients listing on a supermarket loaf, it is truly terrifying. You're absolutely right there. There's a lovely recipe section at the back of Fast Food Nation. I'm joking, there isn't.
No. I'm just very grateful to Jill, who says, because we were talking earlier about all the people going to Benidorm to watch Cheltenham in sunnier climes. Well, Jill says, I'm 45 kilometres north of Benidorm. We've just endured 15 hours of continuous rain. It is cold, grey and miserable, but at least the beer will be cheap. Right. OK. Thank you, Jill.
4 minutes to four.
Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Listen to Times Radio every night from 10 for a first take on the stories making the headlines. Plus, explore the wider news agenda with thought-provoking guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. It's your dream nightly destination for the finest mix of news, culture and conversation. Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Explore, plan and now book the perfect holiday inspired by the journalists you trust. Search Times Holidays.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah, much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Based on 2025 Amazon packaging data across the UK and EU.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Blowing my nose at the foot. Blowing my nose at the foot.
So revolting. It really was disgusting. I have to have my headphones turned up quite loud because I'm a little bit deaf later in life. Yeah. And it was like that actually erupted into my eardrum. I genuinely thought, has anyone got a cotton bud?
It's dreadful. And I don't know how many more times I can apologise for this.
Never, ever play.
It's just worth saying, I've only got a head cold because I was sharing studio space with you last week.
Oh, it's my fault.
Well,
is
you
it?
Started it.
Is it really?
Anyway, let's move on because we're about to join Callum McDonald. And you've had a little domestic accident. You've had an accident,
oh,
haven't you?
Oh, so, Jane, honestly.
Well, it's sort of half funny, but go on. What's happened to you?
It's just the world's most embarrassing irony. I woke up on Monday morning full of vim and vigour to re-embrace for the 20th or 30th time the idea of getting fit, moving more, eating well, yes, generally being healthier. And I've, you know, read up lots on this, and I thought the best way to start is to understand where you're at in terms of the problem. And as I reached for the bathroom scales to put that in the balance, my back twanged.
Right.
And here I am limping my way around the office.
It is genuinely a sight to behold.
It's awful.
So you will detect increased energy levels, though, with Callum, because he will be broadcasting to you standing up.
Yes.
Can you just give us your dad's fantastic motto, please?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is courtesy of a physiotherapist that he still occasionally sees, who I think actually worked with the British rowing team once upon a time, then moved to the RAF. And he always says, motion is lotion.
I love that.
And that is what I'm living by today. So I'll be dancing around the studio for the next 3 hours.
Right. Honestly, we have offered Callum drugs and he said, no, that would make
I think he's already on them, to be honest.
So right. Good luck, everybody. Good luck, everybody.
Our thanks to Rosie Cutler, technical operator, Brian Boyden, and John isn't next, it's Callum. Good luck, Callum.
Thank you.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. This is Callum McDonald in for John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. The headlines: it's emerged Sir Keir Starmer was warned that appointing Peter Mandelson as ambassador to the US would be a reputational risk. And 32 countries, including the UK, have agreed to go ahead with the biggest ever release of oil reserves to try to steady global prices. Coming up on the programme, Anna Mihailova, Times Radio's political editor, will bring us right up to date on the most important revelations from the Peter Mandelson files. And as countries agree to release 400 million barrels of strategic oil reserves, will that push the price down, or might it have the opposite effect?
This is Times Radio.
First, though, with the news, here's James Kitchen.
Thank you, Callum. Good afternoon. It's emerged Peter Mandelson asked for more than £500,000 as a severance payment when he was sacked as UK ambassador to Washington. The government rejected the demand, with the former cabinet minister receiving £75,000 instead. Newly released files also reveal Sir Keir Starmer was advised Lord Mandelson's relationship with the convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein posed a general reputational risk. The National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell, warned the appointment was weirdly rushed and unusual. Lord Mandelson's biographer, Donald McIntyre, told Times Radio the Prime Minister's judgment will come under further scrutiny.
If, for example, the Cabinet Office made it clear to the Prime Minister that there was a considerable reputational risk in appointing Peter Mandelson, as one or two sort of rather half-hearted leaks have suggested, then I think that does call into question his judgment. And therefore, it means that it will be that much more difficult for him to shake off the incubus of the appointment.
The Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister says Sir Keir Starmer takes full responsibility for appointing Lord Mandelson, adding he should never have represented the UK. The government says it's ordered an overhaul of standards in Whitehall to boost ethics and integrity in political and public life. Elsewhere, the International Energy Agency is releasing 400 million barrels of oil from its emergency reserves. The conflict in Iran and surrounding Gulf states has disrupted production and delayed exports, causing energy prices to rocket. The UK government says it's giving 13.3 million barrels from its own stockpiles towards the release. Meanwhile, Kemi Badenoch has accused the Prime Minister of U-turning over fuel duty, asking why he believes now is the right time to increase the cost of petrol. It comes as the government faces growing pressure to ditch a planned fuel tax hike. Speaking at PMQ, Sir Keir Starmer insisted fuel duty will remain frozen until September, adding his government will then keep the situation under review. The Conservative leader responded by accusing the government of treating drivers like cash cows.
We froze fuel duty every year from 2011, and in fact, we cut it in 2022 because we care about the cost of living. Labour think drivers are a cash cow. And now, Mr. Speaker, they think that drivers are a cash cow, and now they're hiking fuel duty for the first time in 15 years.
The government has lost its appeal over a terror charge against a member of the Irish language rap trio NECAP. Liam O'Hanna had been accused of showing support for the proscribed organisation Hezbollah following a gig in London in 2024. Last year, the case was thrown out over a legal timing issue, but the government appealed the decision. Police have arrested a 16-year-old boy after a teenage girl was stabbed at a Norfolk secondary school this morning. The victim was taken to hospital with minor injuries after the incident at Thorpe St Andrews School near Norwich. Norfolk police says the boy was arrested on suspicion of causing grievous bodily with intent after searches of the area. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to Times Radio Drive. Today with Callum McDonald, while John Pienaar has the day off. He'll be back tomorrow. The current geopolitical landscape surrounding the conflict with Iran reveals a critical divergence in strategy between the United States and Israel, even as President Trump once again suggests an imminent conclusion. The president's claim that the war will end soon because there is practically nothing left to target brings the lack of a defined exit strategy into sharp focus. The core problem remains. There is a fundamental disagreement between the US and Israel regarding the conditions and timeline for ending the conflict. Without a clear consensus on what constitutes a successful conclusion, the war's actual endpoint, and the full extent of the damage inflicted on the way to that endpoint remain dangerously unclear, ensuring that the repercussions of the conflict will continue to unfold almost by the hour. This unresolved conflict has immediate and severe economic consequences, particularly for global energy markets. The threat of attacks by Iran on tankers, which, by the way, have become reality, has led to a near total closure of the Strait of Hormuz, a critical thoroughfare through which roughly one-fifth of the world's oil supply moves. In response to this massive disruption, the International Energy Agency has this afternoon authorised a record release of oil reserves, making 400 million barrels of crude available to the market. That is unprecedented by way of effort, which includes, by the way, the participation of the UK. It's an attempt to stabilise markets and control prices for consumers, underscoring the severity of this supply shock caused by the hostilities in the Persian Gulf. That President Trump has shocked us all is no surprise. The scale of his shock, though, is still confounding. And so throughout the course of this afternoon, we will analyse it all for you. This is Times Radio Drive. I'm Callum MacDonald. Welcome to the programme. Our top story, the first set of documents relating to the appointment of Lord Mandelson as British ambassador to the US have been released. The papers show the Prime Minister was advised that Mandelson's relationship with Epstein, Jeffrey Epstein that is, posed a general reputational risk. The Chief Secretary to the Prime Minister, Darren Jones, gave this statement to the House of Commons.
The Prime Minister has taken responsibility for Peter Mandelson's appointment as ambassador to the United States. He has acknowledged it was a mistake and has apologised, not least for believing Peter Mandelson's lies.
He also pointed to what the Prime Minister knew about the extent of Mandelson's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein.
Whilst the documents point to public reports of an ongoing relationship between Peter Mandelson and Jeffrey Epstein, the advice did not expose the depth and extent of their relationship, which only became apparent after the release of further files by Bloomberg and then the United States Department for Justice.
Crucially, and listen to this, Darren Jones mentioned Mandelson's request for more than £500,000 for his payout.
Not just two or even three times, but more than six times the final amount, despite the fact that he was withdrawn from Washington because he had lost the confidence of the Prime Minister. The government obviously found that to be inappropriate and unacceptable.
Indeed. Well, on the Times at One with Trevor Phillips, Peter Mandelson's biographer, Donald McIntyre, said Sir Keir Starmer should have learned from Harold Macmillan's handling of the Profumo affair.
And I think one of the really interesting things about this appointment back in December 2024 of Peter Mandelson to Washington is whether Starmer looked him in the eye personally